This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. With the Beat Your Genes podcast, you can listen to us live on www.blogtalkradio.com/beatyourgenes. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. All right. A couple of months ago, about 10 shows ago, we had a question come up about beauty standards for women and whether or not advertisers were influencing the standards for women, whether or not women were influencing standards for men. And it was episode number 116, so I'd encourage listeners to check that out if they have more questions about it. But recently a listener sent me a question on the same topic, and I thought it would be really good for you to reiterate the issue here. So, Dr. Lyle, the female models from several decades ago, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, were often plump. But by today's standards, many weren't attractive and were overweight. So this listener wants to know if this is a result of the standards changing, or did it take advertisers a few decades to figure out what the standard was?
Yeah, good question. And I think we know that this took place. It's more subtle than is generally appreciated. So if you go back and see, if you see some handpicked models, they may be thick, quite a bit thicker than you'd ever see today, unless it was a plus size model, but not typically. So this is a very interesting question, and I just read this question a few minutes ago. I went online and I looked at the biggest names that I knew in Hollywood during that period of time. And so I'll read off some numbers for you just so that we can see that things have been actually surprisingly invariant. So Anne Margaret was 5'4", 119. Marilyn Monroe was 5'5", 115 in her prime. Ava Gardner was 5'6", 120. Rita Hayworth was 5'6", 117. Kim Novak was 5'6", 121. Raquel Welch, who everybody in my generation, every heterosexual male would have given at least two fingers for one night. The 5'6", 118, and Grace Kelly, 5'7", 118. So we can see that these are very lean numbers, and this is all, this is the biggest stars that there were. So, so what was going on was, given the fact that those were the big megastars, those were the sex symbols of those decades. It's interesting that advertisers were sometimes using much thicker models, and it could have been that there was some disagreement and confusion as to how to go about the process of selling products. So I don't know. I do know also the very simple research was done showing that Playboy centerfolds from 1975 to 1995 went through a similar metamorphosis where they got quite a bit thinner, but what remained invariant was the waist hips ratio. And so I think the weights, I can't remember, might have gone from about 125 pounds down to about 115 pounds. So they dropped 10 pounds, but the waist hips ratio remained exactly the same. So at any rate, I think that There was actually more to this story. This was a puzzle for David Buss. And I remember reading some meanderings of some of his thinking and some of the researchers' thinking. I think there is some degree of evidence that in countries where the food supply is less, where food is, i.e., don't think of supply, but relatively expensive, et cetera, relative to other goods, that plumper females are more attractive. And so it could be the case that as our society became with food far more plentiful, and then so many people becoming overweight, the standard shifts a little bit, and it becomes possibly a signal of conscientiousness to be very thin. So I don't know that we have epidemiological evidence of this. It would be interesting to know if somebody's got it, about whether or not the incidence, for example, of anorexia nervosa is considerably more now than it was, say, in the 1930s, in the middle of the Great Depression, where everybody's struggling to get enough to eat. So I have a feeling that some of these things may have to do with food supply issues essentially trickling their way into the culture computations of what is high status. So anyway, interesting questions, and I think that, unfortunately, I think it may not be a clear-cut answer, or it may be, but I don't think that the advertisers were doing any influencing of the standards. I think the advertisers were following trends in the culture, and certain things that we saw were invariant and clearly built into the genetics of the organism is the 2-to-3-way SIPS ratio.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. Every time I discuss beauty standards with friends of mine, we always end up talking about the Italian Renaissance and how, you know, in that period of painting, there's always more plump women, and that was considered,
right,
you know, a symbol of status. So,
yeah, that may have been because of the, there's a lot of speculation about why that may have been the case, the Rubenesque period. Not sure why, and but it could have been these food sensitive issues, and it could be that essentially that the high class women that were being painted, these were probably, you know, wealthy people, and those wealthy people were the wealth was evidence of the wealth was on the bodies, essentially, and as opposed to people that were poorer. So you could have a situation where you could get a funny looking process taking place where under certain dynamics, certain social dynamics, you could wind up with something that is going fairly hard against the genetic code to some degree. Status is pushing against it for a short period of time. Is not typical of what we see worldwide, and certainly when we go back to the statues of Venus, you know, 2,000 years ago, and we see that they are 5'4" and 120 pounds has been the translation of what those statues would translate into real life people today, which is remarkably similar to our Hollywood sirens. So yeah, there may have been wobbles and interesting periods of time where things looked a little different for a short period of time, but essentially we continue to see some of these invariants, and we see things returning back to these pretty similar ratios.
Yeah, I always wonder just how disagreeable the Italian women of the Renaissance period actually are.
All right, moving right along.
Yeah, moving on. Okay, our next question is about cheapskates. Dr. Lyle, what dynamics are in play with the cheapskate? Father-in-law of the listener here is fantastically cheap, won't pay for a hotel, wants to go to Taco Bell if he says, let's go out to Mexican food. His frugality goes way beyond just using a neighbor's Netflix login. He's got a lot of money in the bank, and he lives very frugally to the extreme. I'm confused since he's been successful his entire life, and the family was well off during his childhood. He was so successful that he retired in his mid-50s, and now at 70, his retirement is still secure and more than comfortable. So what force is at play here? When he's washing out Ziploc bags or requiring rides when an Uber would be far more convenient, I start to get a little resentful. His regular judgment and his general disagreeable nature makes this particular quirk pretty hard to stomach. Can you shed some light?
No, I cannot shed any light on this. The this is clearly OCD-ish behavior. This is there's a lot of conscientiousness in there. There's some, I've seen it. Actually, this is not far from my father. And if you would ask my father what's going on inside of his head, he would. I actually did at one point. I cross-examined him on his thinking about sort of sweating over a minimal purchase around food, and he stepped me through the logic, and he basically said, "Well, if it turns out that when I'm older and I can't make any money, and I'm living off my savings, and I literally go through it all, then I'll wish that I had saved the $2 on this pizza." Okay? So that's what was in that particular head. So you're like, my dad could articulate, he didn't just have a vague anxiety. My dad actually could articulate right down through the chain of logic as he was essentially walking me through what was going on in his computations, which was the worst case scenario. And so it's just what it looks like. Like you've got a worst case scenario. So this person is looking at this guy and saying, listen, he's got more money than he's very comfortable. It's like, yeah, well, how comfortable? What if he needs to, go to the third world and buy himself a kidney and it costs $500,000 and then he's got to bribe a bunch of people and then it all goes wrong and then he has to fly back and then he has to admit the terrible sin that he has and he has to get a defense attorney, but he's got to get to Johns Hopkins anyway and he has to donate $1 million for a wing so that they fix him. It's like, what if? Okay? The truth of the matter is, in principle, there's never too much money. And in theory, there might not be enough for something that you might want. So what we're looking at, I think, is very high conscientiousness, which drives the worst case scenario, and it drives it in a variety of perspectives. So some people, it will drive it into, having their house super clean and free of germs. Other people, it's going to be making sure that they are half an hour early for any business meeting. And in other people, it's going to make sure that they don't waste a nickel. I have a relative. I have a relative that has a comfortable eight-figure net worth, so people can like do their little math, and that's what it is. And so it turns out that this individual, if you go to their house and he pours you wine, at the end of the night he will pour your wine back into the wine bottle. Which is one of yet another reason why I don't drink wine. So, in any event, this sort of thing, I think that's what you're looking at. Is you're looking at, and in this case, and actually interestingly enough, in this individual also quite disagreeable. So when you start realizing that there would be others around somebody's wealth and that they would be essentially wanting to have reasonable access and share processes and joint decision-making in and around the wealth, and it turns out that we've got a disagreeable human that has this highly frugal, hyper-conscientiousness chip, that it can get rough. Like, you can't push them around. They're like, no. And so this is the disagreeableness, I think, probably helps the process. Probably if we looked at all misers, we would find that one of the characteristics would that they would be disagreeable and not just have this specific kind of anxiety. So great question, and it got me to relive that moment of discovery that I found when I found out that was
that's
what
enough
was happening.
Not ever. Yeah.
That's right. All right.
You never know.
Now,
and
what Dr.
Lai, I was curious too about people who have hoarding, who are hoarders.
Yes.
Is that hyperconscientiousness as well?
No, not exactly. I think it's in there. And remember, it's not like what we have is like a set of five or six ingredients or a jukebox in here. What we're talking about is we use words like conscientiousness to describe a pattern of behavior that seems to be associated and clearly is associated with gene variances and has a plays out in behaviors that are somewhat similar from individual to individual. So we have to keep in mind we're looking at impressions of sort of broad characteristics. Now, hoarding, to me, it does have some of those characteristics. So hoarders feel the anxiety that they may use something someday and they don't want to give it up. And a lot of times it has to do with saving these Ziploc bags that this person was talking about. So in other words, it's starting to cross over and look a lot like that. Hoarders have a fear that they're going to need something. And if you think about animals, human beings were able to start to produce things of value that they would carry with them, you know, probably in the last 1 to 2 million years, maybe longer, but probably not. It's probably around a couple of million years ago is when they started carrying little tools around. And then in the last 500,000 years, when they were effectively truly human, they were probably carrying around quite a bit of things, clothing, you know, moccasins, little tools. In other words, we've seen evidence of a lot of little things that they carried around in the last 100,000 years. So you can start to imagine that you would have anxiety about losing things that you had acquired and probably acquired at quite substantial cost. And so as a result, you could start to get the feeling of not wanting to lose anything and to keep it. And so this is sort of protecting the wealth. And so hoarding, you know, looks like this, and it's I could be wrong about the derivatives of this. It could be something a little bit different in the kind of sort of behavior that you'll see in animals that will collect things, particularly collecting food. It's not the only thing animals collect. But I have a feeling that instead of being an instinct that came down all the way from a chipmunk for storing for winter, I don't think so. I don't think it has to do with that. It would be moderately interesting to see if equatorial peoples are as likely to be hoarders as people from northern latitudes. If there's a difference there, that would be notable. And it might be a derivative of food storage and anxiety about food storage that crept in and became a bigger issue in the last, you know, 150,000 years. I think it's more likely to be a variant of personality about, you know, the conscientiousness of something that could be useful and that we're giving it away. So I think it's similar to this, but you know, it's not clear to me exactly what it is.
Okay, fantastic. So
all right.
We've got two callers on hold. We're going to take one question, and then we'll get to the callers. So,
okay.
Dr. Lyle, so last show and a couple of shows before that, and in Chef AJ's webinar, we heard you talk about the concept of keeping your time valuable. And the example that you gave of having – you know, 1,000 hours or 100,000 hours or $100,000.
Uh-huh.
Every time you give that away, you can't take it back. So this listener asks a question, Dr. Lyle, are the concept of an energy vampire or drama queen, meaning that these people somehow feed on our energies or need upheaval and be in the spotlight?
Okay, so let me see if I understand the question. Concepts are that is that they feed on our energies. Well, let's talk about what I really mean by this. That what we're talking about is that there are people that will use various strategies in order to basically take some of your energy. So you're designed by nature. Your entire motivational system is designed around the principle of energy conservation. So everything about you is being filtered through an evolutionary history to build behavioral strategies that will optimize the use of energy in order to reproduce genes. So that's how you're built, and that's how all animals are built, is they're built with energy expenditure being front and center in terms of motivating the organism to do whatever it's doing. So it's going to turn out that one thing that we will see happen is that there are and people will do a great deal of trading. They'll do more trading with each other than any other species trades with each other. In other words, this is the most social of all animals. So you could say, well, a bee is pretty social, but they're not trading with each other. They each have their a little isolated job that they do. You're not watching exchanges between thousands or groups, groups of individuals, and you're not seeing all kinds of different trades for all different kinds of purposes. There is nothing like a human. So a human, and not only do they trade, part of that process of trading is also insurance. So this is what friends are about, and families wind up being insurance policies to some degree, that the fiber of that is benefited through Hamiltonian math because we have shared genes. But the bottom line is that energy utilization, energy conservation, these are core concepts if you're going to understand anything about why any creature is doing anything that it's doing. And so it's no surprise that there are individuals among us that are going to be people are designed by nature to use manipulative strategies in order to get essentially to have a net energy plus for whatever it is that they did. So, and that's fine. So some guy that's, I don't know, he's selling tacos. He's trying to make a profit and thereby be energy efficient so that he has more money in his pocket so he can go trade for more things. And he's trying to be as efficient as he can about that. And he's also trying to sell you those tacos for as much as he can get. Okay, so to blame what I call energy vampires or drama queens as if they are independently different from other people in principle would be a mistake at one level. In other words, everybody's out to get as much energy efficiency as they can get, including these people. The difference is that these people are using emergency mechanisms, and there are threats, there's anger, there's tears. In other words, they're manipulative as hell, and they're essentially potentially activating paternal instincts, paternalistic or maternalistic instincts in us by their crises that they have. They're also threatening us with anger if we don't do what it is that they want. And so as a result, what happens is these people are a lousy cost-benefit analysis when it comes to the expenditure of your energy. So they wind up taking more from your life than they're giving. And that's what it is. So when we say, are they feeding on our energies? I mean, not like a vampire, but they are attempting to manipulate us into doing things for them that ultimately don't make a lot of sense when we see it from a variety of perspectives and alternative choices that we had. So we can get hooked in by their drama, and i.e. same thing with the drama queens. In other words, they can start to make us feel like they are in trouble, they're in an emergency, and one unit of our effort now is going to be the difference between them experiencing a huge loss and not experiencing a huge loss. So our natural calculus says, oh boy, this is really worth it. because they're really in trouble and they really need this help. So it activates altruistic mechanisms inside of us. This is where compassion, arises in the system, and it signals to us that we want to do this good thing because it turns out it's biologically profitable for the two of us, for me to expend this energy and for them to consume it. And then they're going to owe me because they got 20 units, 20-to-1 payoff because they were in such an emergency that I mitigated the emergency with some of my effort. So it turns out that these are the boys and girls that cry wolf. And so they're always in a crisis. It's always a, et cetera. And so this kind of manipulative tactics, I mean, they aren't consciously and deliberately doing this. They just are. They've got emotional instability, disagreeability, low conscientiousness. They've got a constellation of characteristics that make them very expensive to deal with. And so that's why that's why it's important for us to analyze and get a real feel for who, what these personalities are and how to spot them and really understand that these are stable characteristics within the organism that are going to have repetitive emergencies that are going to be expensive. And so, they aren't, quote, feeding on our energies like a vampire, and they don't, quote, need to be in the spotlight exactly, but they are trying to steal our energy, and they are willing to go into the spotlight and show how vulnerable and pathetic they are and how upset they are and how angry and how unfairly they've been treated. In other words, they're willing to raise hell and social turbulence in order to have mitigating concessions from the village. So that's what I mean by this. And that's hopefully that, helps us understand what we're dealing with.
Fantastic. All right, Dr. Lyle, we're going to take a couple of callers.
Cool.
Caller, this is an anonymous caller from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show.
Yes.
Hi, Dr. Lyle.
Hi there. How you doing?
I'm okay. A little nervous. I wrote down my notes. I practice like you always say when you get nervous, so I don't have to just speak off the cuff.
Very good. Okay.
So,
all right. Tell us a story. Go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to know how to handle my husband's drinking and anger. He drinks almost every single night, about 3 to 6 beers. He doesn't have his priorities straight. He'll buy like fun toys, exercise equipment, vitamins, electronics, and then he won't consult me about it. Then he leaves the important things like his car registration. He neglects those things, and then I have to pay penalties. When I confront him about it, he angry and starts yelling while not letting me get a word in edgewise. So I've tried flooding the circuits by pointing out his strong points, what I love about him. And when I express my concerns, he gets upset and says, "You just gave me a compliment and now you're saying this. Which is it?" So I'm at a loss. In the past, he's told me he wants to work on these things, but I don't see him making any effort. I think he's just telling me what I want to hear. And I'm extremely frustrated. When we got married, he quit drinking because I had told him it was a make or break for me. But soon after, he started again, and it's never really stopped.
Got it. Okay. And so how long have you been married? About?
5 years.
5 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And the two of you have any children?
No.
Okay, so no children, and are you childbearing age, or is this a later life relationship?
A later life. I'm not of childbearing age.
Okay, so your later life relationship. You've been together for 5 years, and you're real frustrated with these behaviors. How would you describe, say, how happy you are with the relationship in general?
It's up and down. These are really huge points for me that aren't changing at all. And then there's a part of him that's so loving and so caring. And then sometimes I almost feel guilty, like, why can't I just accept him the way he is? Because he accepts me the way I am. But then I think, well, I'm not doing those careless things. So I sometimes I have these guilt feelings that, you know, I don't know how else to say it, but when I talk to my sister, she says, you know, you guys are always up and down. I know you love each other, but it's always the same. I hear, you know, one day you're in love, one day, you know, you're frustrated. So I think the trend is like an up and down thing.
Yeah. So my guess is, if this is a later life relationship, are the two of you fairly well, had you kind of taken care of yourselves up to then with careers and so forth, or is one person supporting the other at this point, or how's that working out in terms of the financial dynamics?
Actually, when we got together, I kind of was saving him from, you know, he was homeless and whatever, and I helped him out as a friend. But of course, when I took him in, things changed when he expressed his feelings for me, because I have known him for a very long time. We dated when we were young, so we had always kept in touch. Then he, you know, his work picked up, and he has a very good career and a stable one, and so did I until just recently. I left work on his urgings to go back to school to pursue another career, the third one in my life thus far. So now I'm in school, and he's the breadwinner.
Yeah, okay. And so in terms of your own sort of personal finances and so on and so forth, are you – so at this point in the game, are you effectively dependent on him for a while? Or have you –
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Yeah. So this is a – this is the kind of situation where it would be impossible for him to not understand that you are dependent. That would not be possible for him to fail to be able to compute this. And
right.
So essentially, you are in a position where it would be probably pretty, you know, inconvenient, or I'm not sure what your career was and how easily you could resume it, but it might be inconvenient or even impossible or difficult for you to then sort of turn the corner and become financially independent again. Is that true, or could you easily resume what you were doing and be self-supporting?
I could possibly do that. However, I don't want to do that. I really am looking forward to a new career, and it's a very promising career. And in 2 years, my life will change dramatically.
Right. Okay.
If I stick with this program.
Right. That's good. It sounds like there's a new chapter in your life coming that you're planning and investing, you know, this process in. And one of those investments is to be in the relationship that you're in. And one of the prices of being in that relationship is that, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tin. And your husband's paying all the bills, and he wants to drink 3 to 6 beers a night, and he wants to have poor judgment. And when you say that it causes you to have to pay penalties, you're not paying those penalties. He's paying the penalties because he's the one that's making all the money. Okay.
Right.
So essentially, you have placed yourself willingly and reasonably in a position of financial vulnerability and need.
Yeah.
Okay. And as a result, he has no fear that the biggest card in your deck when someone is, you know, when you're very frustrated with their behavior, essentially you signal to them that the cost benefit of the relationship is putting you in a position where it's starting to weigh on you that you may be better off without it. That's called anger and frustration, okay? And
yeah.
We signal that in a myriad of ways, and you have signaled it. However, the person on the other side is generally quite competent at seeing through your cost-benefit analysis and understanding your situation. And so this is why, you know, sometimes you'll get abusive situations where essentially the man will know that the female has options and he will essentially threaten her life or her well-being physically, because he knows that if he does not put that threat in there, then she would leave. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're not dealing with a situation anything close to that draconian. You're just dealing with a guy that's, you know, got an alcohol issue, and you know he's not falling down drunk, but this is kind of how he lives, and this is how he wants to live. And he told you 5 years ago he wasn't going to live like that, but then once he sort of ingratiated himself into your heart and you guys got married, then he decided, no, actually that is how I want to live and that's how I'm going to do it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of what has happened here is when I see the situation, what I see, we might say, okay, well, what magic words, which you tried, flood his circuits. And essentially what we call stroke kicking. So we tried
mm-hmm.
to stroke him and kick him to try to get his attention and
yeah.
to try to get him to, you know, to take some psychological pressure off of you with things that are frustrating you. And
mm-hmm.
he's not buying it, okay? His anger when he yells at you is his signal to you that he feels like you're being unfair, okay?
Yeah, basically.
So,
yeah,
go ahead.
I said, yeah, when he yells, it's like he's really trying to shut me up. He'll try to yell
right.
really loud until, you know, I shut up. And until then, he just starts yelling and cussing, you know, all around the house.
Right. Right. And these are threats that he's basically saying, he's signaling to you, I'm not renegotiating. Okay, you're out of line, you're unfair, I'm going to do it my way, and that's that. That's what he's telling
mm-hmm.
you. And so, and you know what? I believe him. So I think that he's going to continue to behave just like he's behaving right now. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, until you are earning a paycheck again, this is how this goes down in all probability, and I don't think there's anything that we could probably do to change it. It's you sort of looking at this thing, staring at this 2-year price in the mirror.
Yeah.
If there's any other way for you to get this schooling other than being with him, if there's a mother or an aunt that you can live in the basement, if there's some
mm-hmm.
part-time work you could do to feed yourself, there's a student loan that you could take out and move out, etc. If there's any
mm-hmm.
other way to finance this new adventure, then I would look into it, plan it, get out your pencil, and see whether or not you can execute it. And then if you can, then we can threaten him. Okay?
Yeah.
Then we can say, listen, you know what? I want these things for your own good. I want these changes. And if you don't do these changes, that's fine. You can live your own life, but it won't be with me.
Well,
okay?
Interestingly, yeah, I did do that a few days
mm-hmm.
ago because I was thinking
mm-hmm.
I'll live with my dad or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, freaked out. I don't think he expected
yeah.
it. And he,
right.
And all of a sudden I got a call from when he was at work saying, you know, you pushed me that night and I just said things I didn't mean. Of course I want to work
mm-hmm.
on these things. And I said, well,
right.
I said,
there
none
you go.
Of your... I said, none of your actions show this. Your actions actually show me what you did tell me, which was you have no intentions of changing. So how do I
mm-hmm.
believe that? And he got upset
mm-hmm.
with me. And immediately he's like, you exaggerate things. And I said, well, wait a minute, what happened? I thought you just said you were wanting to change, and now you're saying I exaggerate things. Which is it? Let's talk later. You know, I'm at work right now. And, you know, so that's how it was left. So that
right.
threat is on the table. And
if he called
my bluff, I would leave. I'd rather not. I'd rather try to make
right.
it work. But I will. So what is my next thing to do when we do have this talk? And he's trying to convince
yeah.
me he really does want to work on everything.
Well, that's fine. In other words, I think that essentially you played out the first move in exactly what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And the truth is he did get anxiety. So he did call up to, you know, apologize and be conciliatory. Didn't go so well because you weren't in too much of a mood to have it go too warmly, because you don't basically trust the words.
I don't.
Cheap talk. Right,
yeah.
I understand, because you saw the cheap talk before the marriage, and then you saw what happened afterwards. So
yeah.
you know, this is one of these deals where usually when we're confused about what direction to take our lives, in principle what we want to do, the reason why we have confusion is the brain is running all different alternative scenarios, and it's attempting to grasp a hold of the master cost-benefit analysis that is happening as of analyzing two or more alternatives, courses of action. And so sometimes you just can't do it. It's too difficult. It's too difficult to do, so people procrastinate on decisions indefinitely, waiting for circumstances to change in order to tip the balance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can usually do better than waiting. So very often people just wait and procrastinate and spin. But we can do better than that, and one of the ways we can do better is we can sort of take the fight to the problem, and we do that as best we can by running experiments. So we want to run benign experiments where people are not hurt and costs are not incurred, or as little as possible, where we actually see an alternative universe in what it is that we're doing. So in this case, if you could, quote, go live with your dad, if your dad would let you go over there and park over there for a couple of weeks, then you could just go park over there a couple of weeks. We don't change the dynamics. Nobody files divorce papers. You just decide you're going to take a little break, okay?
Mm.
Well, now you get to see what it feels like to not be watching the 3 to 6 beers go down and whatever behavior you don't like every day, and you get to see what that feels like. And he also gets to see that you weren't bluffing, okay?
Right.
That you are actually willing to take these actions. So now suddenly your threats have a tremendous greater potency. And so now everybody gets a little bit better look at the situation. You may go to your dad's and feel like, God, I'd rather live in a Russian gulag than with my father. And so my husband's not so bad after all. See what I'm saying? We're not sure what you're going to feel. Or you may feel like, you know what, this is a hell of a lot better than living with my husband. The hell with negotiating, I'm out. Okay? So we're not sure. And because we're not sure, that's why we run experiments. So in general, the art of intelligent decision making is to try to get a small experiment going that will shed a little bit of light on the macro cost benefit problem, and in doing so, we make a little decision, and therefore the big decisions are not big and daunting, because we're not feeling the world, you know, hanging in the balance of our lever. We get hints of what it is that we really want, and then if 2 weeks goes well, we do a third week. See what I'm saying? This is how we do it. We basically creep our way to decisions rather than make them dramatic. And meanwhile, the threats are heard loud and clear, and they're not empty threats. And so that's how I think I would go about this problem. I would analyze the daylights out of an alternative strategy staying there. I would begin to execute superficial details of that plan, like going to your dad's for a week or two. And and thereby, you know, essentially amplify the legitimacy of so that his map of his brain sees that you've got this alternative scheme that you very well might use, and therefore that starts altering potentially. Well, it will alter his cost benefit analysis on his own behavior. It may not be enough to change it, and so these are that's how I would go about suggesting that you manage this. Okay.
Okay. Since we're supposedly talking this weekend, do I wait to see what he has to say, or just run the experience?
Oh yeah, you could talk to him this weekend. Let's hear what he has to say. Okay. And then come afternoon or evening or Monday evening or whatever, and we're down another six beers and we got some other things that we didn't like, then it's no problem. Okay.
Okay.
Then we don't threaten. We just do all the background work to what it is that we're going to do, and then we execute on it.
Okay.
Then we let him know, hey, you know what? I'm going to take a week off. I'm just going to go to my dad's. You know, just get a feel for it, and no break, and that way you can do what you want to do, and I'm going to we don't have to be in the middle of this conflict, and just take a little time off. Boom.
Okay. Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. It makes a lot of sense.
All right. All right. Very good. Well, listen, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Dr. Kyle.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
All right, caller. Thank you very much for the call and very great question. I look forward to seeing how this plays out. Dr. Lau, that's great. Closed a few loops in my head as well. That's really interesting. How I really like this concept of running little small experiments and making a small decision before you make a big one.
You got it. Yeah. I don't think we're going to have time for the second caller, but
they hung up anyway.
Good. That's good. Yeah. Just to sort of understand just from a big, wide, global perspective, just to sort of recap this, that all a brain is a cost-benefit analytic engine. That's what it's doing. And so that means it's running alternative scenarios. And the human mind being the most extraordinary, you know, machine that there is in the universe that we know of, it's running multiple alternative scenarios on how to handle things. And it gets complicated. And so in this case, there's a lot of values on either side of the equation. There's a relationship of great significance, and on the other hand, there's a great deal of frustration. And so it's the person is basically saying, if the person acted differently, I'd be happy to be here. But they're not acting differently, and I'm not happy to be here. But they could act differently, and therefore I might want to be here. But I'm not sure what the odds are of them acting differently, so I'm not sure I want to stick around how long to find out. It's like it's complicated. And so and when we look at all, quote, tough decisions, all tough decisions are complicated. Values are always in conflict. That's the nature of values, is that they are inherently conflicted. And so so there's always going to be you may love that beautiful new car, but the price is a little more than you wanted. And there's another car that isn't quite as fancy, but it's cheaper, and therefore we'd be more comfortable financially. It's like there's no end to it. Your whole life is nothing other than a series of decisions on this very problem. So it's good to have a decision-making strategy, or actually a set of strategies. And the concept of running experiments by isolating what we think is the core variables involved. In this case, the core variable was either I'm in the marriage or out of the marriage. Okay, that's the core variable. And in it, one reason that would keep us in it is if we had enough threat or enough traction in order to change the behavior of the person on the other side in a way that is not unreasonable. Okay, it's just uncomfortable and they don't want to do it. And so So as a result, the question is, what is the alternative look like? What will it look like if we choose the alternative course of action? And the answer is, we're not sure what it looks like. We got to go find out. So that's how we step through trying to get an assessment of these parameters. And so little bits of data sometimes are all we need to clarify what looked like a big decision, and then it starts tipping in a we do it because we're not sure what we're going to feel like, and we're not sure how other people are going to react, et cetera. But by making small decisions that are inexpensive, we can sometimes clarify a great deal of stress.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyles, as always, thank you for coming on. We'll look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Absolutely. Fantastic, Nate. We'll see you soon. I think next time, I think we're gonna be down in Los Angeles. I'm going to see you.
Yes. Yeah, Dr. Lyles is actually coming to the Fasting Escape this Sunday. You can go on fastingescape.com, and we'll have a video up in a couple of days after Sunday, where you guys get to see the talk as well.
I get to see that beautiful place again. It's fabulous, Nate.
We're looking forward to having you, Dr. Lyle.
All right. We'll see you all soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.